To mark the 15th anniversary since the end of Operation Telic, BFBS has spoken to people who served as part of the operation, who have shared their stories and experiences with us. Please note, these contain accounts of war and conflict, which some may find distressing. If you or someone you know are affected by anything talked about in these interviews, then support is available at bfbs.com/audience support.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
My name's Adam Summers. I was on Optelic 4 in 2004. I served with the 1st Battalion, Princess of Wales's Royal Regiment. My role was a sniper. I was a sniper within Sniper Platoon at Simicas. A role of a sniper is we are the eyes and ears of the battlefield, so we'll always push ahead of a lot of things and we'll log, report, monitor and take out key targets.
My name's Darren Coventry. I was Royal Military Police and I served on Operation Telic 3 and Operation Telic 11. Whilst I was on those telics, covered a variety of roles, but mostly I was in mentoring of the local police forces, training the local police forces and some general police duties.
Hi, I'm Major Cy Reynolds. I was on Optelic 5 and Optelic 11. Optelic 5, I was a plant sergeant with the Royal Engineers, 6-5 Field Park Squadron. And for Telic 11, I was the SQMS of 7 HQ and Support Squadron.
My name is Zoe Robson and I served on Optelic 7 with 111 Provost Company, and my job was policewoman. We'd be dealing with general crime like thefts, assault. We could be dealing with traffic accidents, but also from another side of the scale is potentially taking DNA from Iraqi detainees.
My name's Dan Panter. I was an RLC cap badge. I'd done the original Telic in 2003, 2006, which was Telic 8, and Telic 9 in 2007. As a chef in the army, we were providing food for the frontline soldiers on a day-to-day basis.
This is the famous Basra Road. 25 miles up there is the Iraqi border. In just a few days' time, these members of the Black Watch could be heading in that direction.
So when we first found out that we was going to Optelic, I never felt so happy and over the moon in all my life. We got put in there obviously for Telic 4, which is a peacekeeping tour. It was about 11 months after the initial invasion. Spent 11 and 12 months biting at the guts to get there. So to be told we was going there, over the moon.
We all knew that at some point we would be going out there. It was 2005. It was quite a scary thought knowing that just 2 years previous we had lost 9 RMP in a very short space of time.
I guess excited. We'd spent a long time training, and ultimately when you're in the military you want to train to deploy and you want to deploy.
When the information actually came through to say we are packing our bags and we were going, we was actually in the bar getting drunk. So the feeling was like more of a celebration, and it was our last ditch saloon to get the last few beers in Germany.
I think my mum was quite shocked at the thought of her daughter going to Iraq. I still think my mum thought I was playing soldiers up to that point.
When I told my mum I was deploying, instant fear, as parents would have. And I remember her saying to me, remember what Forrest Gump did. If you get into any trouble, you just run, Simon, run. And I remember writing that in the letter, as well as telling me as well, which is quite funny. The naivety of the fact that although she knew, you know, having come from a military background, that I was going on tour, you know, she didn't know the ins and outs of my job.
Just before we went is when the Royal Military Police had that incident at the police station. So it was quite all over the news. And that's probably about 4 weeks before we went out there. So it was very worrying for my family and friends.
So we actually went over as the advance party due to the regiment I was attached to, which was 1 UK Armoured Divisional Signal Regiment in Hereford in Germany. We flew from Brisenorm, we flew to Cyprus, to Akateri, flew from Akateri over to Qatar, and then from Qatar we flew into Kuwait. You could tell the invasion had started. I think beforehand, I think everyone was like in good morale, in high spirits. Whilst we were all excited, there was definitely a nervousness behind that excitement. First day in actual Iraq itself, when we crossed the border from Kuwait through Safwan village into Iraq just south of Basra, it was quite surreal. The atmosphere changed, knowing that we were then going to take up residence in Basra Air Station. That was the hub. It is, okay, we've now crossed over the border into a war zone, but the unknown is now staring down at you.
We came in at night time. I was sat on the floor of, I think it was the Chinook, and everybody was really quiet, no lights on.
So initially, when you arrive, the things that stick in my mind are the heat.
The heat hits you straight away.
The heat.
The heat kind of hits you first.
Nothing like I'd ever experienced before. The smell is just a general smell of burning oil in the air, sweaty soldiers, cam nets. It's really hard to describe, but it's kind of all comes together. That really sticks in my mind.
The busyness. There was always something going on, whether that was helicopters going around, whether there was vehicles, whether there was alarms somewhere, all sorts of different things that at any one time you couldn't sort of pinpoint where they were or what they were.
And then you just have to do what you need to do, follow orders and crack on.
A normal day in the early days was very much mentoring local police. Usually we would be visiting local police stations, trying to work with the police, understand their needs and wants, what equipment have they got, and then trying to work with them to train them on how they should operate as a police force, because they'd been at war for a long time, they'd been hugely decimated, and some of these people had been police for a very long time, but under very different regimes. On Telic 3, I ended up becoming an instructor at a police academy, so multinational police academy had been established in a place called Azerbaijan. We had instructors from all over the coalition, including civilian police from the Met in London. So that's when the training and mentoring became a lot more formalised. So everything was planned, all delivered in Arabic using interpreters. And, you know, we built like a really solid foundation then for what would then go on to be the Iraqi police forces in the south of the country.
None of us could wait to get out because you bounce around. So you'll do, I think it's QRF1, QRF2, patrols, stand down and guard. So when we got out there, our platoon was on guard. And sniper platoon was the smallest platoon. So normally you call it Sanger bashing. So I'd go from Sanger to Sanger, an hour on each one, and then you'd have 3 or 4 hours off. But because we were such a small platoon, you'd probably have about 2 hours off and you'd be bouncing around again. But you were so excited to be there and wanting to get involved and feel it and taste it that it's probably the only time in my life that I couldn't wait to get back on stag.
You know, my first tour was very much an equipment manager in a plant troop. And then any construction tasks that we had around the base, whatever they needed, they had. So myself and my boss used to go around each site we needed to. My second tour when I was the SQMS, it was making sure that all the stores and equipment that we've got to support the guys that are doing their jobs out on the ground, that they have, you know, damages, demanding anything new, materials that they needed, they had. So very much G4 focused.
The daily life for a chef was sort of pretty much you were up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You were always split into different shifts. So you're doing earlies and middles or middles and late, or you'd do a night shift. But quite often it didn't go to plan. And, you know, there were times out in theatre where we had worked for probably 48 hours straight to ensure that the food was distributed to those that needed it, especially those that are out on the rebros. But the most important thing was that the lads and lasses out there on the ground were getting fed.
Then we went on patrol, and my first patrol on the 18th of April ended up in a 4.5 hour firefight. It was literally a baptism of fire. That patrol was to go and visit some of the local police stations to go and do the hearts and minds part of it. So we pulled up to a police station, but right next to it was the Muqtada al-Sadr's office. Now, Muqtada al-Sadr at that time was causing a massive uprising against the British and the American forces. We literally parked outside his house, which was probably, looking back, not the brightest of ideas, but we didn't know. A grenade come over the wall, bounced off my team commander at the time, Daz Williamson's chest, bounced off his chest, went under the vehicle and went off. I was getting to the back of the vehicle at the time, got blown out of the vehicle. So then we pushed forward, had to grab Daz, drag him down. We turned left into an alleyway, we're now facing the Muqtada Sadr office that way. Got Daz into the vehicle, start giving him first aid. Danny Mills, our platoon sergeant, saw one of the militia coming over the wall with a weapon, with an AK-47, so just said, right, rapid fire. And then we was in a 4.5 hour full-blown firefight. Our sort of eight-man team, which was now down to six, trying to fight our way through up and down this alleyway, jumping over walls, coming into little retrieves and all that sort of stuff. And the feeling that I had was just massive euphoria. I felt alive. I was so happy that I'd done it. I'd been in a firefight and done what I was trained to do and done it very, very well with people around me that I loved, trust, and also done an amazing job that day. But I remember the next morning thinking to myself, if we've got this for 6 months, we're in trouble. And we did have it for 6 months.
I think most people will say it's being away from family and loved ones. You know, just when you think you're coping with homesickness, then a letter will come in from home, you read it, and then instantly it's that rush of, ugh, I miss home again. Being away from the normality of being at home, away from your family and your children and loved ones. The biggest memory, and I think a lot of people will relate, is, you know, the amount of rocket attacks that came into Basra Airport was quite a lot. And I remember being on PT one morning with a friend of mine, Neil Jennings, and we were running and the alarm went off. And obviously you have to hit the deck. And we only expected a few, that was it, coming in. But the alarm just continued. And then the barrage kept going and going. And we were thinking, oh no, please don't get any closer. And it continued for about 15 minutes. This was probably the first time I heard silence. Complete silence, probably the most scared I'd been then. And then when it stopped, you check yourself and it's like, oh my God, okay, things are good. And we got up and we just ran. We ran all the way back to our unit lines just to get in our bed spaces. And I don't know why, it was just your bed space at the time, those sort of coffins, as we called them, were like the place you needed to be to feel safe. And it turned out that day I think it was about 29 rockets had hit camp that day. Yeah, that was the lasting memory of that one.
So there is a moment that stands out to me more than anything else, and it's a moment that still haunts me to this day. And by doing the right thing turned out to be the wrong thing. I gave my food, my ration pack and my water to a young family, and as a result, their lives were taken as a result of me doing that. So on our return journey, when we found them deceased, the interpreter had spoken to local people and said it was because we'd given food and water to the locals. The Iraqi regime had told the local population not to accept anything. The feeling of living with that it has haunted me to this day, you know, some 23 years later.
The hardest thing about being in Iraq was going on R&R. When you're out there, you are together, you're in a team, you're doing stuff. You don't really think about the things that you're having to deal with. But when you come out of there in a very quick time period, you're expected to integrate and act like somebody who hasn't just seen or done the things that you've done. And then you go on leave for 6 weeks and you're expected just to be normal, act normal and get on. So that was probably the hardest thing about being out in Iraq.
Yeah, the one thing that will always stick out in my head, that apart from various firefights, is as a sniper, the first target that I took out with a sniper rifle, 827 metres, as Mort platoon went out, Baz Bliss got shot, and the team that was helping him, they were pinned down by a lone gunman. Snipers were up onto the roof. Dal Norman, the badge, our sergeant major, amazing man, said to me and Fitz, with two snipers were up there, have a scan around in the area and see what you can see. And as I scanned, I could just see at the bottom of a bush a foresight of an AK-47 sticking out, but I couldn't see where the person was because he was covered by the foliage. So I kind of worked out, right, rifle's there. So Basil got a shoot on here. He said, lads, if you've got the shot, you take it, son. Got the range, 827 metres. I put in 830, just give me a bit of leverage. Calculated the wind, put the windage in, and took the shot. Obviously, as a sniper, you work on ethos of one shot, one kill. I didn't know where he was, and my attitude at that time was, well, if I miss him, it's going to wing past him, he's going to stand up, I'll see where he is, I'll take him with the second shot. But I took the first shot, and I just saw the AK-47, the foresight just dropped to its left, so I knew I'd hit him. You really didn't have time to sort of dwell on anything or think anything, and in some respects, like, that's my job, you know, I wanted to do it, and I liked to think I was fairly good at it. But also as well, like we would always sit down, have a fag, we'd break down and we'd say, oh, do you remember this? Or do you remember that? Or, and you talk about it, which in some respects, I think kind of was our own sort of therapy when we sort of would sit around and talk about it with a cup of tea and a fag.
The blessing I had when I was in Iraq was I had an amazing section commander. Her name was Sarah, and she just looked after all of us. Her leadership has stayed with me. I felt so blessed to have somebody who not only was a female, but also somebody who was very strong in character and really looked after us. I just made everything a lot better. We had a really brilliant Christmas, actually, because of her. So yeah, I'm very thankful. I think without Sarah, I would have really struggled.
What did I miss most about home? I mean, this might seem quite simple, but grass. Being able to see, smell and walk on green grass, because in the Middle East, especially in the summer, everything is just brown and dusty. Then that leads on to the pub garden. All of the days we would spend reminiscing about sitting in a pub garden, having a pint, and then the rain. One thing I did do when I came home from my first Telic tour, it rained. I just went outside and stood on the grass and just got wet. It's surprising how much you can miss these things when they're just not in your life anymore.
I missed my son. He was only sort of a year old.
The only thing I missed was going for a pint with the lads, going to see Millwall. That was really the only thing that I really missed. I was where I wanted to be at that time.
I think most soldiers will say that they miss their home comforts, like having a bath or, you know, having a shower that lasts for longer than 30 seconds.
The thing I miss most about home was family. You take for granted just being able to pick up the phone, talking to your mum or your sisters just for a minute or two can have such a huge impact, and not being able to do that when you want to or when you just need a cuddle. That was probably the biggest thing I missed about family while I was out there.
BFBS kept my morale up, presenting and also listening, because, you know, the service is designed for that. It's designed to raise morale in troops. One day at a weekend, it was normally on a Sunday, where my whole morning was taken up doing BFBS. So being able to work and present the shows was really good. Someone said to me, oh, it's nice to hear a familiar face on the radio, knowing that I was a serving soldier on the radio, playing the tunes that they all like, reading their messages out to loved ones, meeting messages out across, you know, across the Middle East, you know, filled me with a bit of pride, but also kept my morale up and kept me focused. The memory that sticks out the most for me, I was helping Andy Asprey and Jeannie Carlin on the Christmas show, and it was going out across the UK. People were allowed to phone in and give messages to their loved ones. And I remember answering the phone, good morning, BFBS. And this lady was on the other end of the phone. She goes, oh, I'd like to put a message out to my son. His name's Simon, and he's with the Royal Engineers. And I was like, Mum, is that you? And she said, is that, excuse me? She said, is that you? And I was like, yeah, it's me, Mum, it's me. She was like, oh, my God. So I ended up taking a message from my mum to me on air, which was quite good.
That was kind of our, like our outlet at the time was BFBS, not only for morale, but for local news as well. Many of the lads sort of got like a little video replay from BFBS to say, you know, I'd like to say hello to my family and that while they're out in Iraq and things like that. And seeing people's faces light up and grown men come to tears because their families delivered them a little message from BFBS was absolutely amazing.
One funny thing that really does stick in my mind, I was out on the road with a multinational training team, and we were delivering training in a place called Samawa, just south of Baghdad. Another RMP guy, friend of mine, we'd finished our lessons for the morning or for the day. So we'd gone off exploring this industrial site that we were on, and there was this huge 300 meter high tower, and we decided it could be quite fun to climb this tower and see what we could see from the top. We get to the top, there's a platform, we're set up there. And then suddenly, from out of nowhere, rounds of pinging past us all over the shop in every direction. So we think we're under attack, but also we think we can't climb down the ladder because all these rounds are pinging past us. So we had to just kind of lay low for 20 minutes until it all died down. Unbeknown to us, further up north, Saddam Hussein had been captured, and the rounds that we had experienced was all the celebratory gunfire of everyone in the local area, including the police who we'd been training. So when we were that high up, they sounded really close. So yeah, that sticks in my mind. And my friend Willie often talk about that.
Morale's always a good thing. You're always cracking jokes, taking a mick out of someone. I think the best one we've done is my number two, my spotter, Smudger, Adam Smith. Great kid. Very good looking fella. Lovely long blonde hair. Bit of a ladies man. Was on the internet at the time. And this is 2004. It's way before all these dating sites and all that. But it was something, I think it was MySpace or something like that. And me, Daz Williamson and Fitz, we set up a profile of this woman. And it was pretty much Smudger's dream woman. She drove the car that he liked, done the job that of a woman that he wanted to do, but she was a dance teacher and all this. Messaged Smudger. Smudger was coming back and saying, I've met this girl and talking to her on the internet. I'm going to meet her when we get back. And I think we kept that going for about a month, and then we told him that it was us. But what the best thing about it is he'd be in that room and we'd be in this room to message each other. So, yeah, bless him.
Coming home after deployment, everybody will say they have different ways of dealing with it. I think coming back to the silence was quite the bit that hit me the most.
It was a very quick kind of exit. Everybody was together, tours finished. We went back to Hona and I think we had like 2 or 3 days of decompression and then that was us off and leave. It was kind of very strange going from one world to another.
We came home in end of October, start of November. So we've come back and it's bonfire night. And we're at Simicast, we got mortared quite a lot. So you've come back from that and you're constantly walking down the street, fireworks going off and you're kind of like ducking and diving and people looking like you're nuts. And you're kind of like, oh, I've just come back from Iraq.
We were on such a high. We hadn't lost anyone despite it being quite a kinetic period of insurgency. But ultimately, we were young. We'd saved up loads of money. And we just went into this period of enjoying our downtime, going on holidays, and then coming back to work, getting back into training, because we knew we were going back again probably within a year.
Telegate in 2006 was definitely the most difficult. And it was on that tour that things started to hit home, and things that happened out there, the things I experienced and things I'd seen, suddenly caught up with me very, very quickly. To the point where towards the end of the tour, I was actually casualty back to the UK.
You get put into this world that isn't normal. The sights, smells, sounds, and it can be something very little that sends you straight back there. When I was in R&R, there was some building work going on opposite my mum's house and this operating machinery dropped and I hit the deck. And for a couple of seconds, I was back in Iraq, even though I was in my room at home. But the sounds, those things almost are embedded in you from a cellular level. Fireworks sometimes going off when you're not expecting them. On Remembrance Day, certain alarms going off take you straight back there. And those things, I don't think ever leave you because you're put in a place that isn't normal. It's very hard to shake off the sounds, the smells, the sights. And I can appreciate how veterans who maybe don't have support coming out of that would really struggle.
When you come back, it's then the understanding, because you get caught up in all the media, what's sort of spoken about out there and why we went. It's the understanding. Did we go out there for the right reasons or not?
For those that weren't there or haven't experienced that kind of operation, I think you really have to separate the tactical on the ground, what's happening with the politics. They are very separate things. The military are there to enact what the government of the day want, but they're not involved in the politics. So why we were there is a very different thing to what was happening whilst we were there. At the time, it felt like we were doing the right thing and we were doing good. In Basra, the locals were happy to see you. They would wave. They would be welcoming. It was the right thing to do at the time.
I think I'd want people to understand that we're, you know, that is our job. We have to deploy on land, you know, to help, you know, and support our country. And whilst everybody has their own political views on things, ultimately, you know, we were there to do a job. And I think we did a good job in the tours that we did. Did I think, you know, we made a difference? I think from my perspective, I'd like to think we made a difference.
Change can happen. the regime out there for the local people was not good. And we saw that firsthand. And over the years of being in theatre, you could see the change. We built schools, hospitals, supplied medical aid, and much, much more. And I know some people will argue about the reasons that we went out there, and I'm probably sceptical of that myself, but there is definitely a better way of life for the people out there now compared to what there was before we went.
All these years later, I reflect on it with and a massive sense of pride, love for the people I serve with, and I'm extremely proud of what I've done out there. For the time I was out on Optelic 4, probably the proudest I've ever felt about myself ever. To say it doesn't change you would be a lie. It does change you. For me personally, there'll always be a part of me left there.
Having served in Iraq and been abroad, it's very tough to integrate back into normal life, into civilian life. As a veteran, seeing other veterans struggle, I can understand. And I think it's important that there's more knowledge and people are more aware of veteran struggles due to being on tour.
Would I do it all again? Absolutely. We would in a heartbeat. Would we do it again knowing what we know now and the way that we've, dare I say it, been treated by the government? Probably not. I don't think the support and help is there for many, many people. And I've lost too many friends since due to the lack of support from the government. Whilst they're quick to send us, they're not quick to support us when we get back.
There were new challenges and new experiences, new emotions. I think that's what made it what it was the first time round. So that would be the big difference. And I don't think it would be the same. So I probably wouldn't go back there.
If I was given the opportunity to do it all again, I would absolutely do it. I feel very lucky to have served in the British Army for 12 years. I absolutely loved it. I have some great memories. And yeah, I'd absolutely do it again.
If you asked me if I wanted to go again, absolutely. If it's the right thing to do.
If I was given the opportunity to do it all again, I'd say what time's the flight and I'll be there tomorrow.
BFBS, the Forces Station.